Chief Justice, you were on mute. I don't know if I wasn't hearing you if you were speaking.
Then I got muted again by some unknown hand. Thank you. Okay, so we are all together and we are going to begin now. Please be sure that you unmute Attorney Rosenberg because he's going to be the first one to speak to us. So I will now call our third case of the day, State versus Dobbs. Attorney Rosenberg, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. I see you're unmuted, so we're happy to hear from you. You'll have to look in the corner of your screen, and you'll see that there was a green sheet that just went up that said start.
I see it
okay.
Now.
Okay. In a couple minutes, we will show you, 20 minutes, we'll show you the 5 minutes to go, and then we'll show you a red stop, and then you will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. So if you are prepared to proceed, please do.
Yes. Thank you. Madam Chief Justice and Justices, may it please the court. My name is Attorney Michael Rosenberg. I represent appellant petitioner Timothy Dobbs in this matter. The first issue has to do with the interpretation of Wisconsin's adoption of basically the federal rule in Daubert on expert witnesses. This court has said on at least two occasions I can find that the role is to ensure that the courtroom door remains closed to junk science, which is usually reliability issues. From my experience and from reading cases, and I have brought these before in federal and state court when I represented chemical companies, it's usually the reliability issue. Here, that's not a factor. Nobody disputed the reliability. It went to the second issue, relevancy. And I don't believe that either the trial court or the court of appeals properly considered the relevancy issue. The defense did raise with when they put on the expert witness and discussed it that they would be contesting that the confessions, the statements to the police, were false and that would be a trial issue. As the amicus brief pointed out, false confessions can lead to false convictions in about 25% of the cases. So here, this was definitely relevant to the issue, and I don't believe that the court properly considered it. There are a number of risk factors here for Mr. Dobbs. The length of the interrogation, that he
counsel,
was in
custody. Counsel, before you go too far on that, could you address... Before you go too far on that, could you address the applicability of Section 907.02, specifically with respect to the requirement that the expert apply the principles and methods reliably to the facts of the case?
Yes. I believe that it's a mistake to read that language, though, that they have to testify specifically about the plaintiff or the defendant. Because if we read it that way, we would have excluded the expert in Smith, and more importantly, in civil cases, more so than criminal cases, we'd be excluding people like epidemiologists who never apply to the specific facts of the case. For instance, in benzene and lead paint and asbestos, which I did hundreds of, you would often call an epidemiologist not to testify that the plaintiff's actual illness was caused by that, but that that chemical in of itself can't cause that type of injury. It's a different type. If we limit this just simply to somebody has to specifically look at that individual plaintiff, or in this case, a defendant, and comment on that, then we've cut out, in the criminal cases, false confessions, because we can't have them commenting due to hazel.
Well, there is some, shall I say, in-between ground there. It's not necessary for the expert to arrive at the ultimate conclusion and say, based on my scientific knowledge and whatnot or specialized information, I believe he's lying or I believe these are false confessions. He could simply say, all right, given the background, the information that I have, and the testimony in this case, here are the factors that involved in this case that would suggest the possibility for false confessions. And that would not be excluded on the basis of the expert testifying to the person's truthfulness. It would simply be tying his information and knowledge to the circumstances of the case, wouldn't it?
It would not violate, I believe, Hazeltine in those cases. However, the expert there is going over to what the jury really ought to be doing. In these type of general science experts, they're not going to comment specifically on the facts of the case. They're giving general information. As the Seventh Circuit said in Hall, this type of information lets the jury know the phenomenon of false confessions exists, how to recognize it, and how to decide its facts fix the case. The same as in Daubert, where you had the benzene issue, they were testifying whether or not benzene can cause this type of case. Benzene can cause different types of leukemia, and there were other ones for which there's plenty of science that it can't cause it. The same way with lead paint and asbestos. Those are the ones I'm familiar with.
But in those cases, that you're referring to, isn't the expert at least connecting his expertise to the injury that is undisputedly at issue in those cases?
In his testimony, he's not specifically going to connect it, but he's talking about information that the jury then can either connect or not connect. The same thing here, that Dr. White was going to testify about certain instances where false confessions can occur in cases of lack of sleep, anxiety, depression, mental illness, and then it's up to the jury to connect it. That, I believe, is the way. Otherwise, what we're going to do is close the door on relevant and useful expert information that a jury needs. Now, whether or not the jury concludes along with the expert, that's the jury's role. And by cutting this out, especially because at the time it was cut out, it was apparent, there was no way it wasn't, it already had been ruled, that all those statements were coming in. So the defense needed, and the jury needed, and the jury very well might have concluded, we can't, based on the evidence, say that one way or the other, that, okay, he's not falsely confessing. But that's really the jury's role, and we've taken away an expert that the jury needs in this type and in other cases to really do their job.
So, counsel, what do we do with that language in 90702?
I think what you do with the language is it is applying, the witness applied the principles and methods relied to the effects of the case. The witness is talking about, you definitely would cut out for relevancy if the witness is talking about something that has absolutely nothing to do. So let's say, for instance, there isn't any issue of false confessions here, that it's straightforward confession. Nobody's raising the issue, but they want to put a defense witness on to talk about false confessions. That would not be relevant. It would not be applying to those specific facts of the case.
Yeah, so this isn't just a different way of saying relevant, is it?
I think it's a different way of saying relevance. Those are the two issues that Daubert and the courts looked at under that language, is whether or not it's reliable and whether or not it's relevant.
Okay, if what you're saying is that Daubert suggests that there is a relevance and reliability factor, and that's all we should look to, that might be true if we were simply applying Daubert, but we're not. We're applying 90702, correct?
Which is, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, correct.
With the microphone. Yeah. We're applying the same statute, though, that Daubert applied and looking to it for precedential value. And it's the same. So Smith applied the same thing, and the witness in Smith was able to testify and wasn't. There are some cases where the prosecution has put up an expert witness and said, and whether or not it violates Hazeltine is a different question, but to say things closer to what you said before, that based upon this, you know, it's consistent with somebody who's telling the truth or somebody who suffered this. But Smith is the same type of witness. This is the background. This is what happens with these types of victims. And here,
right. I want to close the loop, though, on this the language. So the way you think we should read 90702 is, if scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge, blah, 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 all the way down to the last line of sub one, instead of, and the witness has applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of the case, we should read that as just, and the testimony is relevant.
Well, I think it's Yes, because applying to the facts of the case, and I think that's the same thing. But yes, that is my position. That's how I think.
Can I offer a different way, counsel, that you might also agree with, that I think is more in line with the federal rule, which is what we're modeling after? If we look at the evidence advisory committee notes, the way that this is, the last part is described, is that the testimony fits the facts of the case. So it has to be more than just relevant, it has to fit. But would you agree with that, General?
Yes, and I think that I cited something, either that or something similar in a brief.
Okay, so that's a little bit different than relevant, and it's not quite having to have an expert talk about the facts, because the expert doesn't have to say anything about the facts, as long as the attorney can connect the facts to the expert to make, to show that it fits, right?
In this type of expert, yes. In other types of experts, it would have to be. If you've got a doctor testifying about what its specific injuries are, then yes, it has to be specific facts. But these
types of experts, now taking you back to this case, if I apply that test that we both just agreed on, the problem I'm having is, first of all, it's a discretionary standard, so we do give discretion to the trial court, but the other thing is to actually look at what Dr. White said he was going to talk about. And let me just look at my notes here, if this was Dr. White or if this was, yes, Dr. White said that he was going to talk about confronting the suspect with evidence of guilt, being indifferent to claims of innocence, lengthy questioning, persistent questioning. And then the most important one is minimization, when the police attempt to persuade the suspect that what you did really wasn't all that bad. And that's what he focused on. And if we look at the facts of this case, couldn't a judge, as this judge did, say that, you know, who's, how do you connect those? This guy was, I mean, I know the facts, you know the facts, but those factors he talked about really didn't fit into this scenario.
And some of those, but he also said that he testified persons with mental illness, for example, anxiety, depression, or exhaustion, are more likely to make false confessions. It's those, it's that risk factor that's really more here.
So the one, you're focusing on the one risk factor.
Yes, that's the main risk factor in my mind. Has to do with his mental illness and everything related to it. Using mental illness and abroad, and he did use the terms anxiety, depression, or exhaustion, all of which Mr. Dobbs allegedly was suffering from and had informed the officer he was suffering from.
It sounds like either way, though, you'd ask that we clarify how the circuit court presented the Daubert standard that we now have adopted.
Yes, and there's not a whole lot in Wisconsin on Daubert. There's been more and more, and as the cases that really, if you look at Jones from a couple years ago, Seifert from the year before that, those are all reliability ones. Other than Smith, which didn't directly hit this issue, but it was the same type of witness, I've not been able to find anything in Wisconsin that so far has really discussed this. This is all a little bit newer to the state of Wisconsin. I think this is an important issue to be clarified. Whether you rule in my favor or not, I still think it needs to be clarified. And that, to me, was the issue that was more important for this court to address. I know you've got other interests, but this is an issue that this court has not dealt with on this part of the expert witness, after our prior expert witness standard that had been in place for decades and decades, if not longer than that.
Counsel, could we just move to the Miranda question in this case? And I'd actually like you to talk about the harmless error piece for a minute here. Suppose you're right that the pre-Miranda statements should be suppressed. Give us your best argument as to why the harmless error rule shouldn't nonetheless preclude the relief you're seeking for your client.
I think if that was the only issue, then you're right, harmless error would kick them out. I think they step into then the argument of involuntary statements. You're right. If all we have are those prior to, and I forgot the DR Pines giving Miranda and then Officer Milton giving it, that there are certain things in there that he learned that were inculpatory. However, in the larger scheme of things, they probably would be harmless error. As I said, if that was the only issue, I wouldn't even be here, I don't think, on an appeal on that issue. It's the involuntary stuff that then starts to come out of that, and that's the bigger, to me, Miranda issue here, which then loops back into the whole expert issue. Everything's sort of in a circle.
One of the questions the court wanted addressed was whether we needed to overrule the Court of Appeals decision in Morgan. And really the discussion there was the difference in standard in custody vis-a-vis a Fourth Amendment type of seizure and custody vis-a-vis a Fifth Amendment protection against the right of self-incrimination. And I don't think either of you really talked a lot about it. So I'll just ask you directly, counsel, do you think we should overrule Morgan, or is it correctly stating the law?
The short answer. I'm sorry.
I hear you.
It's my microphone that's giving me, I'm hearing feedback. I did discuss it shortly. The state put it in a footnote that they agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm missing what the court was getting at. I don't think there's any reason to overrule it. There's a difference between Fourth and Fifth Amendment.
Right.
Clearly. I never raised a Fourth Amendment issue here. Morgan discussed it. This court, actually in Martin in 2012, also distinguished custody for Miranda purposes from a temporary roadside detention. It's not directly Fourth, but that could turn into a Fourth Amendment. There's different here. It's a Fifth Amendment issue. The court in Morgan didn't make a per se rule. It stuck to the totality of circumstances rule. I'm not sure if I'm getting at what Your Honor is getting at. I don't see anything in Morgan to overrule. I don't think it made any blanket, you know, even if somebody disagrees with the end result of Morgan, it never made a blanket statement. It made no per se rule. The court recognizes, you know, if you're looking at the handcuffs issue, that doesn't necessarily equal being in custody. That's about all I have. I can't find it, and maybe because I'm missing the thought process of the court on why Morgan is an issue. The Court of Appeals did not cite it. It sort of talked about totality of circumstances. The real problem is the Court of Appeals used a Fourth Amendment case, which isn't applicable here because we're not talking about Fourth Amendment.
Right, we're talking about the Fifth Amendment. Okay, so why don't you give me your best argument about the point at which Mr. Dobbs became in custody for Fifth Amendment purposes and why?
I think he's in Fifth Amendment purposes from almost the time the officer gets there. The officer, and in fact, the trial court judge thinks there's probable cause to have arrested him immediately. He puts him in handcuffs, says he's detaining him, puts him in the back of his car. I think if you look at totality of circumstances and whether or not a reasonable person would feel that they were able to leave, in this situation, he's not going to feel that. The court more recently,
wasn't he told he was not under arrest, though? Didn't he ask that and he was said, no, you're not under arrest?
And was just being, quote, detained? He said he was detained. I don't remember Mr. Dobbs asking if he's under arrest. And
okay.
I've forgotten that. I apologize. I'm not saying blanketly because there's so many facts and I've tried to read everything over again. But he said he was being detained and he put him in the back of a locked car with handcuffs on. He, at some point in there, very close to when he does that is when, to me, under this court's and the United States Supreme Court's rulings, if you look at the totality of circumstance, whether or not a reasonable person would feel that they were allowed to leave, I don't see how he would feel he's allowed to leave.
Counsel, so this is the position where I would expect you to push back hard against Morgan. Because in Morgan, the defendant was handcuffed, placed in a squad car, and the Court of Appeals found that a reasonable person in that circumstance would feel free to terminate the interview and leave.
I think Morgan looked at it under those facts, and I think looking at it under the facts here, he should be determined to be in custody. There's a little bit of difference, he's detained for a much longer time.
But if we follow what the Court of Appeals said in Morgan, then we would find that Mr. Dobbs, I think, was not in custody, right? And that a reasonable person in his position would feel free to tell the police that he didn't want to talk any further and that he was going home.
But Morgan and all these other cases looking at a case-by-case basis, there's no per se rule in Morgan. It's that same totality of circumstance, the same that the court applied in Bartelt. And here we've got a guy who's got no experience with the police. He says he's being detained. He's put in handcuffs. He's put in the back of the squad car. He's then kept for hours. At some point in there, as opposed to Morgan, where that didn't happen in the same fashion, that turns into in custody.
So, okay, I just want to push on this just a little bit further because I looked at Morgan and I could not make heads or tails out of that. That's one of the reasons I was interested in hearing the presentation today about that case. How, if we stick with the standard that a person is only in custody if a reasonable person would, under those circumstances, totality of the circumstances, would not feel free to terminate the interview and leave the scene. If that's the standard, how can we even begin to rationally say that a person in handcuffs in the backseat of a squad car would reasonably believe sitting there in handcuffs that he's free to leave?
But my honest opinion is almost nobody in handcuffs is ever going to feel reasonably free to leave.
Well, yes, and that's kind of the point, isn't it?
Yes.
And so the question is the standard stated appropriately?
Do we have
to move what we consider to be in custody, or do we have to change the standard by which we determine who's in custody?
I don't think we have to change a standard. First of all, it's also U.S. Supreme Court standards, this court standard from years. I don't necessarily agree with the end result in Morgan, but Morgan doesn't come out and say that anybody in this situation, this is always what it is. I think under the Fifth Amendment, this is always has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. Personally, I don't know how anybody other than a hardened criminal who has been through this numerous times is going to think they're free to leave somehow if they're put in the back of a squad car in handcuffs.
I'm wondering what would happen if someone tried to operationalize their belief that they were free to leave in those circumstances. What do you suppose would happen if Mr. Dobbs or Mr. Morgan had decided, you know what, I'm going home, and they get out of the car and start walking off with their hands handcuffed behind their back?
Get out, though. You cannot open the back door of a squad car. So they're in there and they can't get out.
Well, right. So, I don't know, you kick the window out or something so that you can make your egress because you feel reasonably sure that you can leave.
I have seen, and I can't remember where case or story, somebody in the back of a squad car climbing over to the front seat where they could actually get out. And I think then they are arrested and charged with fleeing from a police officer.
Of course they are, because they are not free to leave.
Counsel, in the United States Supreme Court has addressed Terry stops and has indicated that even though you are detained, meaning you're not free to leave, it's still not necessarily a custodial interrogation within the meaning of Miranda. And I wonder how you would take that fact and apply that to the facts of this case.
Not every Terry stop does put somebody in custody. That's why you look at the totality of circumstances. Somebody.
Just to clarify, though, the test, you know, well, this is one of the hard parts about this case and this sort of area of law is that while we sometimes say, would somebody feel free to leave? Obviously, nobody who's subject to a Terry stop who is detained is free to leave. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're in custody for purposes of needing to receive Miranda warnings, right? So the issue in this case is, okay, he's pulled over for an investigation. He's detained, admittedly, in a pretty solid way, put in the back of a squad car and given handcuffs. But at what point does an investigatory stop or investigative stop, as this was, turn into a custodial interrogation? Was he constructively arrested?
In this case, it's the fact that he's put in handcuffs in the back of the squad car and kept for hours. And in other types of Terry stops where he stops someone on a street and say, you know, what's your name? What's your address? Actually, to a certain extent, they could walk away. If there's nothing further, State v. Gruen, getting old and some of the facts get confused in my head. There was a Terry stop and it wasn't converted into custody. It was an officer from a different jurisdiction that held him until someone else got the, and it was just an investigation and he just sort of held him. And in fact, he's just in the car, if I remember right. To keep warm. Oh, I'm seeing stop.
Your time is up, but you do have 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Counsel for the state, are you prepared to begin?
Yes.
Please do.
Yes. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders representing the state of Wisconsin. Dobbs huffed hair cleaner while he was driving. He passed out and his car went across the street, across a median to the left side of the street, up the curb, through some grass, off a tree, and hit a man who was only trying to walk down the sidewalk and killed him. And then he left the scene. What this case is about then is his confessions. He confessed many times to having huffed while he drove. So the two main parts of it then were, should the expert testimony on false confessions have come in, and should his confessions that he made many times that day and the next day have come in. Since I guess we started with the false confession testimony, I'll start with that too. The court.
I just want to ask counsel about the standard of review and how he applied in this case. In some places in your brief, you're even in that sort of heading argument, that it was properly excluded because Dr. White didn't apply the methods and principles underlying his case to the facts here, and the evidence was not relevant, wouldn't have assisted the jury. But in this situation, as I understand our case law here, what we are required to do is determine whether he applied the proper standard of law and did so in such a way by reaching a conclusion that a reasonable judge could reach. So we don't necessarily need to say we would have made the same call.
All right, Richard.
Whether he applied these reliably to the facts of the case. Isn't the real legal question before us whether the trial court reached a decision that a reasonable judge could reach in applying the proper law in reaching that conclusion?
Yes, and I think in this case he did, or the court did, and the court with that reached not only a reasonable decision, he reached the right one. So I guess I was trying to go further than that and say it's not only that the judge applied the right standard of law and he did that well, but he also reached the right answer, which is that the expert testimony in this case should not have come in.
But wouldn't you agree, counsel, that the way he stated the standard wasn't necessarily right? I mean, he applied it, and maybe, and I know that as Justice Hagedorn has outlined, we give the reasonable judge the discretion, but maybe he went a little too far in how he described it. Otherwise, you as the state are never getting in your expert on child sexual assault, because that witness is not going to talk about the facts of the case. They're going to present the state is going to present a witness that just talks about why children delay reporting, right? Doesn't it just have to fit the case? Didn't he go a little too far with saying what it seemed like was the expert had to actually tie it into the facts?
Well, he said two things. And to be clear, he first ruled that the expert testimony would not come in. Then the defense moved for a reconsideration. And when the court addressed it that time, he said, well, I've got two reasons why it's not going to come in. One is that the judge didn't, or the expert did not apply his methods and principles reliably to the facts of the case. And two, the defense has not shown that what the expert wants to say fits the facts of the case.
Counsel, in fact, you set that forth on page 18 of your brief, mm-hmm. that the court has two positions. And I think that the court erred in its first position, but did not in its second position. The second position saying, in essence, as set forth on page 18 of your brief, that the opinions regarding false confession as a general matter, even for educational purposes, did not fit the particular facts of Mr. Dobbs' case. And you cite the record and you go on with the judge repeating himself with showing different examples how it doesn't fit the facts of this case. But as to the first, I say to you, Mr. Sanders, we've got problems. I'll tell you what my concern is. Following up on Justice Dalit's comments, it would eviscerate what's been referred to as a time-honored area of exposition of evidence. Whenever I have an evidence case, I often start with Professor Blinka's writings on the case. And he would be contrary to the first reason given by the circuit court judge that the expert has to tie it into the facts in his testimony. And he says this in a primer on the new evidence rules, that is Daubert. Expository testimony need satisfy only the pertinent requirements of 90702, namely qualification, testimony addressed a subject matter in which the fact finder can be assisted by an expert, reliability, and the testimony fit the facts of the case. So it's not according to Professor Blinker. Now, do you agree with that or you disagree with that?
It's hard to say, because if you read the plain language of 90702, it appears to say what the judge, it appears to read how the judge first read it. However, there is a lot of case law that would seem to say that it's not that in every case for an expert to take the stand, he or she must have specifically applied it to the facts of the case.
In fact, that case law emanates from the notes of the advisory committee on the mm-hmm. federal rules. And of course, the feds enacted codified Daubert before we did. And this is what the advisory committee on proposed rules, but the language is the same. We took the Fed rule. Mm-hmm. And in the second paragraph, they're concerned that this statute, as they helped propose, should not be interpreted to do away with what's called the exposition testimony or the lecture testimony, and they say this: most of the literature assumes that experts testify only in the forms of opinions. The assumption is logically unfounded, and Mr. Sanders, you would never want to be embracing something that's logically unfounded.
I know you.
The rule accordingly recognizes that an expert on the stand may give a dissertation or exposition of scientific or other principles relevant to the case, leaving the trier of fact to apply them to the facts. It seems wise to recognize that opinions are not indispensable and to encourage the use of expert testimony in non-opinion form when counsel believes the trier of fact itself can draw the requisite inference. Do you disagree with that?
I think that makes sense, but I think that what is required is that the attorney then tie it to the facts of the case and show and make some type of showing that there is proof and it's going to come in a trial, which ties it to the facts of the case. And here there is nothing of that sort. There's just nothing. The most that the attorney said is, I think that there might be some kind of evidence of minimization, which there is none. It's exact what his claim isn't that the cop tried to downplay what he did. It's that he told him you just killed someone, and that's when he freaked out. And he said, oh, well, then I huffed. So it's exactly the opposite. The length of time cannot come into play because it's not even close to that amount of time. He only spoke to him for less than 1 hour. There just isn't anything here.
What about mental health and exhaustion? That's what Mr. Rosenberg was arguing.
But what White actually said is, if it's a mental health issue, which can make it so that a person is unable to separate fact from fantasy, there's nothing here. There is no claim that he suffered from anything like that. There isn't the sole proof that came in that he has any condition is that he said, I have a condition and I take these drugs for it. That's it. But there was no testimony there was no showing here at the hearing or any testimony that it would have affected him in a way that would have made him more likely to confess falsely. There just wasn't anything. He didn't make any showing at all. And I think he can't, because his claim isn't that he actually falls under the risk factors that White laid out. It's that when he found out that the man who he hit had died, he felt bad, and then he decided, I guess I should just confess. But that isn't something that White was even going to say as a risk factor. There just aren't any risk factors. There was nothing that, as the court said, this was a standard interrogation. They didn't do anything. They didn't try to make it hard on him.
Counsel, do you believe that assuming that's true and that helps supports the trial court's decision, do you think it would have been error for the trial court here to reach the other decision and exercise discretion differently to allow the evidence in some way? Would that be improper?
I don't know if it would have been wrong. Well, I think it would not have been the right call. But I don't know in a discretionary way if a court could have reached that.
Right. So your position
up to the judge.
Right, so your position would be, listen, the judge permissibly here looks at the evidence, sees that this doesn't relate to the facts of this case in any way, certainly in order to tie it in, and therefore makes a judgment call that is reasonable, even though somebody could have come up, even though a different trial court judge might have reached a different outcome.
Yes. And in this case, it's more than that. I mean, it was obviously right. Because it's not tied in any way to this. And one thing I'd like to add, at the hearing, the defense attorney asked White if a cop holds back on some type of shocking evidence and then springs that on a guy, is that going to make it more likely that he would confess falsely? And White said, well, no, he said, is that a coercive interrogation technique? And White said, no, it's not a coercive one. And he said, you always want to do that because, of course, if you have something which shows that that there's guilt, you are going to want to mention that, and it's not a coercive thing. So it really comes down to, sometimes there are false confessions, but not in what occurred in this case. He said too that there are three types of false confessions, and it is clear that what happened here falls into none of the three. So it's completely worthless evidence in this case.
Moving to the other issue, counsel, I think I saw you concede that it may have violated his Miranda warnings, or his Fifth Amendment right not to have given the Miranda warnings the first time, but that it doesn't matter because it's harmless error. Is that where you are on that?
Well, I think at some point while he was in the squad car to start with, it went from an investigatory detention. It may have started there, but at some point while he was in the squad car for an hour, it became more than that. And so in order to ask him inquisitorial questions, they ought to have read him his rights. I think that most likely is true. But even if that's true, that will not affect his confessions, which came much later, because while he was in the squad car to start with, he didn't say anything good. He didn't say anything which was incriminating. He said, my hand hurts. I take some drugs, which I have not taken. My hand got hurt, but not in this crash. He didn't say anything about what had occurred. He said, I have smoked pot, I have drank, but not in the last few days. So there was really nothing. He didn't say anything which actually helped the state.
Yeah, counsel, the Chief Justice had asked your opposing counsel earlier, and I thought I recall reading as well that Mr. Dobbs was asked during the time that he was detained whether he was under arrest, and that Officer Milton, I believe, said, no, you're not under arrest. We're still basically looking into it. Is that an accurate read of what happened?
I seem to recall that, yes. However, at some point when you look at the Bartelt factors, it would appear that at some point, because he was frisked, he was handcuffed, he was in the back of a locked squad car, and he was asked some questions, some of which were not inquisitorial, and some of them may have been. So I think at some point during that hour, it is likely that it changed into a custodial situation.
Well, counsel, how do we identify that point in time where it trans, when it goes from being a detention to custodial?
I'm not certain when it is. In this case, I don't think it matters, because even if everything he said in the squad car at first should have come post Miranda, it doesn't really matter, because he didn't say anything. He didn't really say anything that the state used. And to be clear on that, when he was tried, his defense was, my hand hurt. I had been taking some drugs. He said I smoked pot and I had drank, but not in days, because when they did a blood test, he did not have any pot in his system and he did not have any alcohol in his system. But that it was the pain and his depression and his anxiety and those things. So he owned up to when he took the stand, he reprised what he said at first. What he contested was what he said after he had been read his rights twice and he waived them. So all that he really cared about was what he said later, because that's when he actually said some things which were incriminating. And the case law, I don't think to start with, the court needs to go to harmless error on that. It can start with, because he then was read his rights and he then confessed, and what he said then was voluntary under Elstad, it's fine. There really isn't any issue. And this court adopted Elstad in Armstrong and said the same thing, that as long as he was then read his rights and it wasn't an intentional thing where the cops chose not to read him his rights as a tactic, which is not the case here, then it really doesn't matter, as long as what he said once he was read his rights was voluntary. And in this case, it clearly was, because when he was questioned, once he had been read his rights and he waived them twice, they didn't use any tactics. They didn't try to pressure him. They didn't try to do anything which would break his will or anything like that. And I think it's clear, because he was told that the man who you hit died. So he knew exactly what had occurred. So he knew that if he said, I huffed and drove, it's a big deal. I mean, it's a serious thing. So it's not like they tried to trick him and just say, hey, it's not a big deal. You know, if you say you huffed and drove, so what? No, it's like, if you say that, it means you just killed a man. And he said, I huffed and drove. And he said, and he would not say that he knew that he had hit a man and then left the scene. So his will was still there. He said, I didn't know it. I didn't know what I did, and I left the scene, but I didn't know it. Had his will been so, if his will were gone because of some kind of pressure, I assume he then would have said, oh yeah, I knew I hit the guy and I left. But he didn't. He denied it all. And since there is no proof here, and there's no claim even that what he told the cop to start with in the squad was important, I think as the defense said, it was minimal. And I don't even know if it was minimal. It was nothing. He didn't really say anything good at all. They didn't ask him any questions because they didn't ask him if he huffed and drove. They didn't ask him if he hit anyone. They didn't ask him if he left the scene when he knew he hit anyone, because they just weren't at that point. But when they wanted to start to ask him questions like that, and they had done more investigation, they read him his rights twice, and he waived his rights both times. And it was voluntary, and as long as it's voluntary, then there really isn't any problem under Halstead and Armstrong. I don't know how much time is left.
You haven't gotten the...
I don't think I've seen the light yet.
You have 6 minutes, so you get a five-minute warning. So if there's something else you want to say, fine. And if not, you know, you don't have to use all six. It's up to you.
I suppose that is a hint.
Speak to us of attenuation.
Well, I don't think it's really an attenuation analysis because the way the courts have dealt with it in Elstad and Armstrong is that it's a whole new thing, that it's just as long as what he said after he was read his rights was voluntary, then there is no issue. I think it's along the lines of attenuation. It's not exactly the same analysis. It's close though. And in this case, because what he said once he was read his rights was voluntary, everything's fine. And even if you don't look at what he said to start with, what he said once he was read his rights all comes in. And then once he had confessed twice, then that night he confessed to everyone when he was no longer being questioned. And that all comes in. I mean, there was no, you would only apply any of this if he was being questioned, and he just wanted to talk. And he kept saying it, and he kept saying, I just took one puff, and I killed a man. And he said that to his dad on the phone with a cop there too, who had just said, you can talk to your father, but we are right here, and if you say anything, we are going to use it. And then he said, Dad, I just took one puff, and then I killed a man. I mean, it all comes in, and what occurred to start with really didn't make any difference because he didn't say anything. So unless the court can find that his statements post-Miranda were not voluntary, I don't think what happened pre-Miranda makes any difference. If there are no further questions, I will be done.
Okay. Thank you very much. Rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the state, I mean, obviously we disagree, is glossing over what goes into the involuntary confessions factually here. This wasn't just a short little time. He wasn't just a little depressed. He hadn't slept. He hadn't eaten. He hadn't taken his pills for anxiety or depression. His hand was so infected that the jail wouldn't take him. He was in custody basically for hours, and it continues on until he's booked actually till the next day.
Well, counsel, before we get to those considerations, don't we have to make the determination that we spoke of in State versus Moore, in which we said in order to justify a finding of involuntariness, there must be some affirmative evidence of improper police practices deliberately used to procure a confession. Is there anything that you can identify in this case that would satisfy that standard?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think this case is not to the level that Hop or Hoppy, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, was, which they did find involuntary. Officer Milton here knew all of his physical and mental issues, it wasn't just that he kept something back like you might do in an interrogation. He kept it back knowing he was going to have an emotional breakdown, which he did. An emotional breakdown, he became suicidal. He's not twisting his arm, but he's using psychological coercion, is my position, which is, at least in my opinion, enough to satisfy Moore, Connolly, and a number of other cases. This isn't missing police coercion, and both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, in my opinion, glossed over that completely and never looked at it, because once you have any sort of subtle, then you should look at the person's mental capacity, and here his mental capacity was terrible.
I understand the perhaps fragility of the state of mind, but it seems to me that that first step is pretty significant, having to find an affirmative piece of evidence of improper police practice. Are we to conclude that springing a piece of information on a defendant that the police know is going to be upsetting to them, that that's an improper police practice?
No, not by itself, but there were a number of others. The way he kept him in custody without addressing any of these issues, I believe that what he should have done was gotten medical attention for Mr. Dobbs, have him take his medication, do after the guy is settled in, and I know why the police want to, and this isn't the worst case I've ever seen, but this guy was basically a basket case, and then making use of that and the psychological, in my mind, psychological coercion made these statements involuntary. And
what's your best case that you can cite to for the proposition that inducing emotional discomfort is an improper police practice?
Well, I think Hopp says it. It doesn't have to be egregious or outrageous. You look at the totality of the circumstances. And Moore said that includes psychological pressure. And I believe there's psychological pressure here. Is it as bad as it is in some cases? No, it's not. But I believe there's psychological pressure here, and that therefore those involuntary statements should have been excluded. And if they're going to come in, and I'd like to loop back around to the false confessions, because again,
before you go to that,
okay,
is it improper any time that the police use psychological pressure? I mean, it's one of the tools in their toolbox, isn't it?
No, and like everything else, you're looking at the totality of the circumstances. There should not be a per se rule that says police should never use psychological coercion. But in this case,
so what are the guidelines that we're supposed to use, other than perhaps we just look at it and we go, well, we just have a gut sense that that went too far. Is there any guidepost that we can use in determining how much psychological pressure is too much psychological pressure?
Well, I think Hopp listed all the different factors you should look at. You know, look at the person's character, how long they've been in custody, what their anxiety levels are. I'd have to go back and pull out the brief. But I think they're all listed there. And the trial court never looked at any of those, and neither did the Court of Appeals.
And I saw that list, and my immediate response was, well, I need a psychology degree to figure out how to apply that to a case. We're mere lawyers here. How are we supposed to deal with that?
But I think that's what judges do all the time, though. And it's why there shouldn't be saying stop.
You can finish answering the question and then conclude.
Okay. It's what judges do all the time. It's why there can't be per se rules. As nice it would be to have a per se rule, it doesn't apply to, you know, one size doesn't fit all. Therefore, I think these were involuntary. And I think we, if nothing else, we needed the false confession expert. And for those reasons, I think the court ought to reverse this and send it back for a new trial.
Okay. We're going to conclude the hearing then. I want to thank you both for your briefs and for your presentations and helping the court and the public out at a time when we're all trying to do things a little differently than in the past. You did a very nice job, and I appreciate it very much, as do all members of the court. So we are going to adjourn now. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:00. We are adjourned.
Thank you.